Coming up next is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with Jerry Pives.
Well, hello, it's Jerry Pives here, and it is Saturday morning, and it is Real People time. Only every so often, I convene the Psychobabble panel so that you can hear the views of the wonderful Dr. René de Monchy, a psychiatrist in New Zealand, and the views of the heroically deregistered psychologist over in Australia, Ros Nealon-Cook, and my humble self, a psychotherapist in New Zealand. So that's one psychotherapist, one psychologist, and one psychiatrist. And I should probably add, that means we also have two turtle doves and a partridge in a pear tree. And as our way of supporting the magnificent work of New Zealand doctors speaking out with science and their conference that is happening right now in Auckland, we thought we would discuss the topic that one of the speakers there is talking about. Now, they brought over a wonderful chap called David Charalambos, and he's speaking about this thorny issue of how do we talk to people who have very different views from ourselves. And so we thought we'd support the listeners, we'd support New Zealand doctors speaking out with science, we'd support David Charalambos by delving into this very complex issue. And I can't possibly begin to summarize what we talk about in this conversation, because you're going to hear it all here, and you're going to hear some very surprising and different ideas on what it actually means to communicate with each other. We're going to dive so deep into this subject, I would have to play you the whole 2 hours just to explain what the 2 hours is all about. So I hope you enjoy this. And to just get us into the groove of psychological conversation, let's listen to the Alan Parsons Project and Psychobabble. Well, that was Psychobabble by the Alan Parsons Project. And I'm thrilled to have in the studio with me Dr. René de Monchy and Ros Nealon-Cook for us to explore all issues psychological. I am actually at a loss for how to begin the show this Saturday morning.
Okay, well, let me then start with a little verse on inner quiet. Quiet, it's actually the German Ruhe, and it also has something in it like it's quietness, stillness, equanimity, all of that. Quiet I bear within me. I bear within myself forces to make me strong. Now will I be imbued with a glowing warmth. Now will I fill myself with my own will's resolve, and I will feel the quiet pouring through all my being. When by my steadfast striving, I become strong to find within myself the source of strength, the strength of inner quiet.
Thank you, René. And if anyone's wondering why on earth we've started the show with a meditation on quiet, it was because I arrived and declared myself frazzled. And this was René's response. So thank you so much, René. I am delighted to welcome René de Monchy and Ros Nealon-Cook. And you've got me, Jerry Pives, here for Psychobabble. And what we've got here is we've got the North Island of New Zealand up in Tauranga-way.
Actually, Wellington at the moment.
Ah, yes, you did say. So we've actually got still the North Island, just at the boot of the North Island in Wellington, windy Wellington. We've got Ros over in the Blue Mountains west of Sydney. And we've got me in the alpine town of Wanaka in the South Island of New Zealand. And René, you're at a psychiatric conference, I believe, in Wellington. Is that correct?
Yes, it's just finished. And it's probably the last time I've been there because now I have to pay for it myself. And these conferences are very expensive. But it being in Wellington, where I did my training as a psychiatrist, I felt that this was a good thing to do. And I meet indeed all my previous colleagues and junior registrars. And I just told Ross that in Brisbane, I passed my last exams in 2003 with two others, Hiran Kartabru and Susanna. And Susanna is now professor in psychiatry in Wellington. Hiran is the head of the New Zealand Psychiatrists Association. And here I am as home, garden, and kitchen doctor. Nothing academic. So it's very interesting that to meet all these people again who I haven't seen for years and years.
And although you're my hero, you're clearly the black sheep of the family who didn't really make it of the three. God bless all those who don't make it, is what I say.
Yes. That the new Sermon on the Mount.
Yes, that's a new one, isn't it? A new Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are they who said no and never made it.
But we can hold hope for them. I always hold hope for them.
Well, I hold hope for you, Roz. I hold hope for all of us, actually. And I'm so well adapted. You know, I always do what I'm told. You've noticed that about me.
Exactly, exactly. You are the ideal taxpayer.
You got me in one. I'm going for this exam in Wellington in November, and I hope all the listeners wish me great luck. And the main problem I have to do is I have to resist the impulse when I sit down and they start asking me questions like, you know, or anything. I say, well, if you want to know who I am, I said, if you add up all your years of teaching between all four of you, all right, it won't come to the amount of teaching that I've done in my life. So what on earth gives you the right to judge my teaching? How do you justify your position right now? Of course, it will be true, but it would be the best way to fail an exam.
Well, there's more eulogy after failure than you say it's for your appeal.
I'll save it for that. But I don't really want to think of failing.
No, I don't think you will. I don't think that you're the failing type.
Oh, I don't know. I have, like many listeners, and you know, I have the most incredible ability to sabotage myself. I don't know if you found that in other people, or probably, I don't know, in yourself, but I find I have this incredible ability to be, you know, as gifted as I am and to have be completely unknown until these three wonderful women in Auckland said, would you like to do a radio show out of the blue? You know, to remain hidden and unknown and yet have spent my whole life dedicated and passionate about healing and about what makes us all tick. I think that takes some level of sabotage, don't you, René?
It's really interesting that you use the word self-sabotage, because I think that is something that we all do actually so often and often so unconsciously as a defense mechanism in order not to either feel vulnerable or sticking your head out or whatever.
Bull poppy syndrome.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't pay, really. I mean, I don't know if it pays or not. I know that we say in TA, it comes right down to what we call script. And I think I definitely decided the best way to survive in my family was to never outshine my dear mother. You know, I had to be never that good that I was better than her. So part of me thinks I'm still waiting for her to die, which is a terrible thing, before I allow myself to flourish. And I hate that. And I've done lots of work on that. But I do keep bumping into it. I find in the most surprising ways that sabotage reveals itself, because, of course, it's in the unconscious. And we do everything we can to change that and to re-script ourselves into something healthy. But, Roz, what have you got to say about this subject?
I think this is such an incredibly on-point introduction into what we're going to be talking about today, because we do have, as you were talking, Jerry, about with your examiners, you have this sense that you'd like to really put them in their place and let them know how much more you know than they do. But it's the very worst thing you can do. And we do have, when we're in vulnerable positions, an unconscious drive to exert dominance. And it's so counterproductive. It's the about the last thing you want to do.
So what is yours, if you would, Roz, if you would talk, because we're really first actually doing this, and I think that's very important, what would be your self-sabotaging?
Oh, I have an Olympic medal in self-sabotage. My self-sabotaging actually tends to go in the other direction of putting myself down and not believing that I am. So I might have those sort of thoughts bubbling inside, but really that belief that, what do I know? These people must know better than me. And I've had to also do a lot of work on that over the years to find my own strength and be able to find my voice when I'm speaking to people who, in many ways, I unconsciously feel are far more powerful, or certainly even ostensibly in the sort of institutional sense. For example, if we're talking professionally, if I'm speaking to people who might be higher up the chain than I am, who have more letters after their name, that sense that therefore they know far more than I do, and who am I to even have an opinion?
This is very good, because I think that is a far more common one than the tall poppy, as it were. And seeing that we are so self-disclosing at the moment, it's actually very good, because what we're going to talk about then, or want to talk about, is how to communicate in a non-judgmental way. And the first thing you need to do is to get a knowledge about yourself. And the whole adage of man know thyself, that already in the Oracle of Apollo. Mine is actually very similar to yours, Ross, is the sense of I am not good enough, which is a very common one. And in my case, it took me to about, I remember actually when I was 42, this realization that I had been told that I was probably part of a twin, and that that other one, that twin, didn't survive. So the whole idea of I survived at the cost of my brother or sister has been there until I realized that that is part of a basis of so much of my feeling inferior or whatever. Also, just after the war set up or conceived, when there was all this suffering and my mother getting TB during the pregnancy. So this whole idea of I am actually a burden and I'm not good enough is really part of that. And until you actually recognize that within yourself, you can't actually integrate it. And I think lots of us have that.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I think it's one of the most critical pieces of the work of, whether you're a psychologist, psychotherapist, or psychiatrist, is to bring that piece very gently to the person you're working with, turning that mirror inward so you can take that really deep look at who you are, how you came to be that way. As you say, it's the know thyself, and then forgive yourself, because a lot of people hold great shame about whichever sort of face they are showing. And understanding your history, how you've talked a lot about even the pregnancy, Pranay, right from the very moment of conception, there's so many forces that are impacting on molding our personalities. And when you really have a good understanding of that, of yourself, it also makes, I believe, you far more compassionate, empathic, and able to forgive others who are locked into a particular worldview that might be at odds with your own.
Exactly, because you, with that, there is no longer the either or. There has come a part of that. And that is exactly what the regression that we often have before we come into an understanding of who we ourselves are. We judge others in this either or, us, them, enemy, friend, whatever sort of way. And that is always a regression. And we see that in time of difficulty. We saw that in the COVID time. We see that at the moment. Just look at the, I'm sure if I would be in Israel at the moment, I would be confronted with there is no life possible unless I come into this either or enemy friend part. And that actually dehumanizes us.
Well, isn't this an interesting conversation? Because the topic we had planned to talk about today was, in fact, how do we talk to people who hold a very different position to the one that we hold and often react negatively to any discussions of the differences between us? And Ros, I wonder, how are you relating what we're talking about self-sabotage, about the ways in which we manage to think we're not good enough, as René said? I wonder how you would relate this, because I think you do relate this to what the topic is, don't you?
Yes, I do, Jerry. And I thought what you started with when you were talking about these examinations and how you would like to put these examiners in their place and let them know how much more you know of this subject than they do combined. And that sort of quite natural, I think, desire for ourselves to exert our authority is when we're speaking to people who are in this situation, if we're talking about COVID, for example, who are very heavily defended against new information that is quite threatening to them, putting ourselves in a dominant position is about the very, very last thing that we actually want to do, because it takes away the sense of safety that the listener needs to have to be able to fully engage with the material so that they can have all functioning of their brain available to take on board this information.
So this is a great opportunity to just have a little music break. And really, because we're talking about how on earth is it that the people around us have become so comfortably numb? And there's a fantastic Pink Floyd track of music that you've chosen, Ros, for us to play. And it's just an amazing piece of Pink Floyd. I'm a total Pink Floyd fan. And it's just a beautiful piece of music about the dangers of becoming comfortably numb.
This is Real People in the Psychotherapist's Chair with Jerry Pives on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
So that was Pink Floyd and Comfortably Numb. Do you know that was one of their most popular tracks? And it was from the album The Wall. Did you also know that Dave Gilmour actually said that that was the very last piece that the whole band worked on constructively together? And that it was also the very last piece of music that the whole band played together. And that was in the historic 2005 Live 8 concert in Hyde Park in London in July 2005. You know, I was just around the corner when they were doing that, and I never got myself to see it. I could have kicked myself. Do you ever do that for missing something? Anyway, yeah, Comfortably Numb. So, Ros, we were talking about dominance and power plays and having power over people. As we try and defend a position, we sometimes get overly powerful. Can you just remind us what you were saying about what happens to the person or the people that we're talking to when we do that?
If we go in with any sort of dominance, any sort of power play, then that puts the listener automatically into sympathetic arousal, that fight-flight piece we talk about so often, and resources are taken away from their brain to the major muscle groups. And the result is that their prefrontal cortex, those areas that we need at sort of maximum power to compare and contrast different ideas, are depleted. They don't have as much energy available. So yes, the dominant position, the power play, very last thing you want to do.
So we talked indeed about the importance to know yourself. Actually, before you even start to have any judgment or whatever, we talked about how we defend it and how later in the course of our lives, we have come to the conclusion of actually, that is my vulnerability that I was defended against. And I talked about that, this sense of guilt in my essence. And only when you come to know yourself about these things, why do I have these defense mechanisms, can I have actually a much more undefended openness, as it were, to approach the people with other opinions. Because before that, you always go from that defended position.
So I'm hearing two different things in relation to how we talk to other people. The first thing I'm hearing really from what you're saying, Ros, is about the need for people not to be dominated and threatened. And heaven knows, you know, we've experienced enough of that over the last few years to be able to, I mean, every person involved in challenging the psychological operation narrative, we know a great deal about how that feels and how that immediately puts us into a defensive place. It puts us into an attacking place. It puts us into a fight and flight place. So I'm hearing that, but I'm also hearing from you, Ene, that you're saying actually another piece to this puzzle is really about knowing ourselves, and that if we don't understand what our triggers are, where our deepest beliefs about ourselves and other people come from, then it doesn't matter what we actually do. Those unconscious forces will probably control how we're behaving. And I want to just say this is a very interesting, because we're actually broadcasting this on exactly the same day as New Zealand doctors speaking out with science are also inviting David Charalambos, and his work is very much about how you hold these conversations with difficult people. And I want to support this. The reason we're doing this is we want to be, you know, this is a hot topic right now, and I want to support his work. But I also want to say that, you know, just talking about how we talk to people isn't enough, because your point, Rene, is so important, that the inner work that we've all got to do to transcend the challenges of these days, it's like a massive big invitation to every one of us to grow, to understand ourselves, and to be more aware of ourselves. So I really want to just say, I'm seeing these two elements.
So that is one thing, is when you say how to talk with people who hold different things. I even go further and feel how to listen, because I can only listen with an open mind when I get some idea of who I am and what my prejudices are. And I give you the example, when I worked in forensic psychiatry, I worked with a group of pedophiles. And of course, unless I actually have examined with the flashlight into every corner of my soul with my prejudices, which of course I would have to an adult who is sexually abusing his child or other children, gives an incredible moral horror to myself. But only when I actually realize how and why that is, can I overcome that. Because this person, this pedophile, is still a patient who comes to me for help. And unless I can really integrate and know where I come from in my prejudices, not saying that the prejudice is wrong or right or whatever, but being aware of it, can I really have an openness? And that is the second thing that I wanted to say. Listening to Ros, I think the cognition that you talk about in the frontal lobe is for me the mechanism by which actually the actual perception of what is happening is actually not in the frontal lobe, is I think in the heart.
Ros, would you like to come in? Because I know how important the heart is, and how your research and all your philosophy around the heart resonance is part of your makeup, actually. So I wonder if you want to come in on that one.
I believe it's the primary work of whether you're a psychologist, a psychiatrist, or a psychotherapist, to be helping the person that you're working with to really be able to go in and almost take a full inventory, and this will take time, of their own sort of soul's development. And Hre talked about some of his childhood, and really I see people as very, very complex recipes right from the moment of conception. And certainly there's a lot of research now talking about preconception, what's happened in, of course, previous generations. There's been so many incredibly complex factors that have interplayed to determine who you currently are in your life. And that involves a lot of very painful pieces often. So understanding who you are, how you came to be, doing that work to really understand what are the pieces that have triggered you, what are your biases, what are all your sort of cultural beliefs. And then from that position, when you really have a good knowledge of yourself, and in many cases, well, in all cases, have forgiven yourself, then that understanding is the sort of fertile soil, I believe, from which you can then build your empathy and compassion for people who hold views that are very different to yourself. There's a phrase, a saying, I think it's from the Bible, isn't it? Something like, unless you've walked 1,000 miles in my shoes. Yes. So, Rene, when you've talked about working with the paedophiles, and of course, these are the incredibly tricky parts of our work, of course, I agree with you that we have to be fully integrated in ourselves. And then again, circling back to that empathy and compassion, while the idea of people, as you say, Rene, who are sexually abusing children is abhorrent, unless we can come from a place of objectivity and have our heart open to the fact that these people also were a highly, highly complex recipe themselves and ended up in this place, how can we know where to go in and to be able to help them themselves? And that's really difficult for a lot of people to take on board, because they want to instantly write off, divide against these sorts of abhorrent behaviours.
We're talking about the role of self-awareness, personal discovery, and in many ways, personal reflection and exploration. Now, we're three professionals in the psychology area, okay? In terms of the listeners who are not psychological professionals, what are we saying about this? What are we saying to them?
I think what we do is, the human being, everybody is a big mystery. And we can start to know a little bit about the other, but we can never fathom the totality of the other. There's always such a huge prehistory, and the same is with ourselves. So I cannot judge the person only on their deeds as they are now, because there is also a past history. And we said that in the way of the pedophile. He didn't start setting out as a pedophile when he was a young child. He was really injured himself in many ways. And it's the same as in the Hitler time, Nazi time. It didn't start with the concentration camps. It started with gradually domination and control by a small group of people to influence a large group of people to start thinking according to their way of how they want the thoughts and the population to react.
Well, it went even further back to the Treaty of Versailles, right? It went to the European powers power playing over the whole German nation and literally bankrupting Germany. And in that bankruptcy, someone turned out, and actually some of the things Hitler did were, you know, horrific. But some of the things he did were very, very smart. He actually separated himself from the whole world banking system and created a German banking system. And he actually was building the German economy. So people were highly motivated to get behind this guy because he was actually helping them. And then, of course, we get the other side. History is complicated. We're complicated. And I even heard an interview by Paul Brennan on RCR very recently, where he was talking to Julian Rochelle, the guy who wrote about The Emperor's Got No Clothes. And he wrote a tremendous article about what was going on in terms of, you know, we do need a boy or a little child to cry out, oh, look, you know, the Emperor's got no clothes on. But he has taken 2 years to write. And he was saying he'd been looking into climate change, into ecology. Listeners, do look up the interview with Paul Brennan, because he was saying, you know, it's so much easier to go to a quick fix, like, oh, we've got to cut down CO2. And he said, and yet, actually, the complexity of climate change is phenomenal. And every time we make a solution, we actually make things worse, because we do not understand the mystery, as you were saying, René, the mystery of life, the mystery of our planet, the mystery of how we interact with each other, the mystery of ourselves. So I just want to say that I think this is really in line with the idea that it takes enormous hubris to think we know anything at all.
Oh, I there's so many directions to go off from that piece, but I'll go with the final point, Jerry. I think, and it's been so said so many times now, but I utterly agree that wisdom really is realizing that you know nothing. And the wiser you are, the more you realize how little you know. And I think that comes back again to that place of humility, is that when we can self-reflect, look at ourselves, warts and all, and really take on board and work through the embarrassing things, the things we're ashamed of, the you know, going through our history, when we can then sort of integrate that, move to that place of humility, then I believe that's, you have to be there really before you start conversing with other people who hold ideas that are so different to your own. Because when you have moved to that place of understanding of yourself, again, you can have far more compassion for someone that you're trying to debate with. So in the example of COVID, because that's the one that we've sort of come together on and are talking about, if we're trying to speak to someone who is utterly convinced that the vaccines, for example, are the way to go, and that, you know, everything else is conspiracy theory, rather than trying to go and debate data with them, which I hope most people have come to the understanding by now that it's pretty futile, is really try to understand their position. How did they come to hold these really strident views?
Well, I think this is a great opportunity to take another music break, because one of the things we've been talking about is the idea of us and them. As seeing as we're having a bit of a Pink Floyd morning, I think we should go straight to their wonderful track, which is my choice today, of Us and Them, off The Dark Side of the Moon. So let's all have a music break and listen to the, well, the glorious Pink Floyd and the track Us and Them.
You're listening to Real People with Jerry Pives right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, that was Pink Floyd's Us and Them off The Dark Side of the Moon. So, Roz, we were talking about the importance of listening to people and really doing our very best to understand them. But surely we can't become their therapists.
Now, you're not necessarily going to be able to go back and work through their whole childhood and understand who they've developed as an individual, but you certainly can inform yourself about all of the nudging, all of the programming, those pieces that were central to most people who have held their views. And again, through understanding all of those manipulative, psychologically targeted techniques, can have an understanding of why they are where they are. So again, I do believe those first two pieces are really know thyself, but then also know the playing field in which the person you're trying to speak to has ended up in that particular position.
The image that comes to mind, Roz, when you speak of this, and I'm trying to gear this to what the listeners can take from this conversation and what they can actually take away, in terms of knowing themselves, the image that just literally sprung into my mind there was of a little girl holding a teddy bear coming out of a bombed area at the end of the Second World War. It's probably a photograph I've seen, but there's chaos and despair and disruption. And this little girl, and this, if this little girl comes out screaming, we're not going to say, oh, you shouldn't behave like that. Oh, we're going to gather her up and we're going to say, it's okay, you're safe now, I've got you. There's this sense of this deeply distressed, traumatized child holding on to a mere inanimate manufactured object of a teddy bear for security. And if you're not their parent, if you don't even know them, that girl is going to be picked up. And if there's any image that I think, and I think, why did that image come to me just then? And I think it's because a part of me is saying, it's time to let go of our judgments. It's time to stop judging each other, but to come together. But we need to know ourselves for that, don't we?
We need to know ourselves. And I believe we need to really work to move beyond the anger. And there's a lot of hatred. There's a lot of very, very strong emotions, and move to that place of compassion towards those that are still in the matrix, if you use that sort of language. I see those people very much as victims. I know the classic example that we often hear in our community is people laughing at people they see driving around with masks on. And I'll admit, several years ago, I was the same. I think I was actually more angry. But now I understand those people have post-traumatic stress disorder. That's not a rational behavior. Those people are so deeply traumatized that they are still trying to protect themselves. And I think that's the key piece. Only if we are holding compassion for those people should we even begin to talk about how we might communicate with them. But if you're going in, Jerry, with your examiners trying to exert your dominance, don't bother. You will actually make things far worse. As you said, Jerry, it's the very worst thing you can do.
Renee, come on in on this, because I think you've got a lot you want to say about this.
I think this is very true, but there is also there this the same danger of judgment, that it can be condescending. They, as you talk about, and that it can be, I'm compassionate because I should be compassionate. It must be even deeper than that. I think we are beings of freedom, and we need to really see that other people with completely different views have a right to these completely different views. To realize that, okay, we try to converse, we try to come to a common ground, and it may be that we find a common ground, it may be that we do not find a common ground, but as long as there is that interaction in a compassionate, reflective way with the other person, I think then we don't come into a judgmental us and them. I can feel, because what I'm thinking about is the picture that you had of this child coming out with a teddy bear out of the bombed out city. And unfortunately, it's a type of picture that we see so much, whether it's a child carrying a violin or a teddy bear or whatever, or the Edvard Munch's picture of the cry, you know, in the Spanish Civil War. It is all the same. And we need to, I think, realize this deep love and compassion for this girl coming out of there, or with the woman who is this cry in the picture. But there's a danger. There's a danger that we smother. And I can see that in patients, if you have, and we know exactly how that is as professionals, if somebody tells something about their story, giving us the privilege to listen to that inner story, and that person starts crying. You will see there are many ways, because we are moved, that we can react. There are some people who immediately embrace that person. In actual fact, with that smothering, the expression that person has with my own feeling of wanting to deal with it because it's too much. Another one is to not pay any attention to it. But that is equally, but then on the other side, really judgmental and not giving that distance of freedom. So what you do is, and we do that automatically, you just briefly touch the hand or you pass the bag of tissues that is there and put that in somebody's hand, because that means I acknowledge the suffering that you have and it deeply touches me. And yet I want to help you to integrate that suffering rather than I put my solution onto it.
Once again, I feel we're in a danger of talking as therapists, and I'm not sure in terms of the general public and the listeners how they can make sense of that. And so I'm just wondering how you would make sense of that for a non-psychotherapist. Like, they see someone crying or they see someone in pain, and they haven't had the privilege of our training to understand the delicacy of, you know, smothering, though they probably all got experiences of being smothered. And it's rather like, how do we reach? And because I see here we're talking about three things, in fact. We're talking about what we say to people. We're talking about how we know ourselves. But we're also talking about how we know the person we're talking to. I feel like the three of us are in a very privileged place of spending years understanding ourselves so we can understand others, and then learning more from others, and that feeds into our understanding of ourselves. The great privilege of working in the psychological area is every story I hear, every person's story that I'm privileged to witness and become a part of, actually. I'm engaged with their story. Every time I do that, I'm actually enriching my own understanding of myself, because I'm reflecting back on myself and I'm asking myself, gosh, I wonder how many elements of what that client is talking about I have similar stuff I resonate with. And we all resonate with people's trauma and pain. The question is, I absolutely love what you're saying, Rainey, that we don't smother people. Although if it's a young girl in deep trauma, I'm not going to wait for the niceties of I'm going to pick her up and do the adult thing, the grown-up thing. But the idea that when we're talking with people, we must give them space to be themselves. I completely am behind you on this. So I just wonder, Rennie, do you have anything to say, if you like, about how we react to other people's distress or pain, not necessarily from a professional point of view?
Well, actually, feeling touched by that and expressing that, without taking away that person's integrity.
So it's about, I remember that Carl Rogers talked about his core conditions for, where he called it actualization. He never called it self-actualization. He called it organismic actualization, the actualization of the human organism. And what one of those core conditions wasn't that we are listened to or that we are heard, but that we know we are heard. So it was so essential. You can listen to someone, they're not aware of your empathy. And for him, a key part of what heals the organism is the idea that we know we're heard. And I think that's what you're speaking to, Rennie, when you say, you know, communicate that you have been touched by what is being said.
That's exactly it. And that's where an apology that the Australian government did to the Aboriginals, or an apology that the Royal Commission for Abuse here is going to do, an apology to misdeeds of the past towards colonialism. I think that is important. So this whole Royal Commission, what they did is to give people the possibility to express what has been there sitting there, unexpressible, and to know this is it, you're actually listened to. You are a unique, worthwhile human being, and we have not listened to you, but we do now, and we acknowledge yourself. You can't walk in the same shoes, but you can try to understand as much as possible of the other person's experiences.
Well, there is that phrase, isn't there? Two ears, one mouth. Listen twice as much as you talk. And I think for the listeners who are all struggling, as I am, as we are, with the psychological pressures to move into separate camps, to make it us and them, to, as it were, bring forth judgment towards each other. But we're talking about the principle of othering, of making a group or another person other, and we separate ourselves from them as if suddenly they're no longer human. And I think it's the humanity of the person we are with that we are all talking to, isn't it?
So the question of how do I come to my opinion? And how do you come to your opinion? I don't know if my opinion is right, because I went with the same information. And until I got more and more information that I felt, am I actually on the wrong track? How do I know? But when you get confirmation of your views, not by becoming more tunnel visioned, but by more openness, really out of an interest. I'm really interested how you come to think the way you think.
I think connecting on the emotional toll is really an important first piece. And then listening, having those first sort of pieces. And then if you can come in with questions of where they received their information from, and see if they're interested. But it's very much about, I think, planting seeds and just getting a sense of where they are. It's kind of like, I'm not sure if I've talked before about how we work with small children. So how in psychology, if you have a client who is a small child and they are traumatized or dealing with some sort of emotional stress, we would never sit eye to eye with them and have a discussion ever, because the whole sort of physiology and body language, I mean, eye to eye, you both know, of course, it's actually a sign of dominance. And if you think of boxers, when they square up in front of each other before a match, the whole reason they do that is to exert their authority and their dominance over the others. And it's found throughout the animal kingdom. So when we work with small children, we often do it through play. We will sit side by side. We will have the primary focus as an activity, because that takes away the fear and the idea of being, or the sense of being challenged. And very gently, we'll plant seeds, gauge how they're feeling, and extend the conversation that way. Jerry.
Renee and I are going to have to compete to come in on this. It's just that you have so beautifully described one of my favorite, when I'm teaching about subjects like this, I always play a Heineken advert called Worlds Apart. And I don't know if you've seen this, but this is the most amazing advert in the world of adverts, it was like a psychological experiment. When people of complete opposites, they didn't know they were opposites. They were brought together in this experiment. So you'd be a climate changer and an anti-climate changer. You'd have a trans woman and a bloke who says blokes are blokes and women are women, you can't change it. And you had a feminist and a guy that said, women should be at home cooking and stuff like that. You had real opposites. But They didn't say, come and talk about your opposites and let's see if we can make peace. That wasn't what they did. They said, here's the task. They didn't know what they were coming in for. It was an experiment, I guess. They were paid something to be there. But they were tasked with building a bar. And it was they had to spend hours and hours, like a kit they had to build together. And they had to work together. And then right at the end, they said, right, you can sit down at this bar. And the two bottles of Heineken were placed, you know. And then they were shown their opposite views. And the voice, because there was no human involvement at all, the voice said, well, you can either leave because of your differences or sit down and have a beer and have a chat about where you both are. And they all stayed. And it's a very moving. Anyone listening wants to get just go to YouTube. Heineken advert, worlds apart. And it's, I dare you to not be moved. And what they did, Roz, is what you said. They literally got side by side engaged in something real, and they had to be human with each other first, and then you get the differences to be discussed. That was my bit, Rennie. What did you want to say?
I wanted to say that we talk quite brainly, in a way, and what you do now is you try to bring in this commonness in a deed that brings people together. It's also in the emotional field, where do we see the struggle coming to expression? In art, any form of art is actually bringing out my feelings. And so the in poetry or in painting or in sculpturing or in music, in singing, remember that we talked about the African people, that they bring into their song all their joys and their huge sorrows. And only a human being can do that. So what you said in the animal being wanting to impress the opponent by how you do that and the whole behavior, that is indeed we have as human beings as well. But we can have one step higher. We can bring it either in a togetherness in a task or individually to actually bring it into the form of art, which no other being does.
Seeing as we're talking about loneliness, Rene, and all the lonely people, I wonder if this is a good opportunity for us to take a music break and play that classic piece by the Beatles that you've recommended, which is Eleanor Rigby. Yes, all the lonely people in that iconic song by the Beatles, Eleanor Rigby. Not that you needed to be told that. And you've been listening to Psychobabble with me, Jerry Pives, psychotherapist, the defrocked for speaking out with truth psychologist in Australia, Roz Neelan-Cook, and the psychiatrist, medical doctor, and psychotherapist, René de Monchy, as we are discussing the perplexing subject of how we talk with people that seem unable to tolerate either talking about science or factual research. Roz, tell me where you think we've got with this panel discussion of ours.
Yeah, look, for me, this conversation is always my sort of Achilles heel, because my sense, and I know David Chamber Ambulus, I can never get the ambulances in, you know, great guy, doing great stuff, but my sense has always very much been that those who aren't, it's inefficient at this point. Those who aren't over the line yet will go when the group does, when it hits the tipping point. Yeah, they're following the pack. They're so defended now. So trying to work with them, it's almost impossible. You've got to get over the pack leaders, enough of the pack leaders. And that's why I put so much effort into Lighthouse, because most people need either pack leaders or pack size to follow if they aren't over yet. So I find this conversation very, very difficult. And it's not something I attempt on an individual level.
For me, to live with an insecurity, to live with, I don't know what is right, but I somehow have this sense of I can trust somehow. I can trust my thinking or I can trust my feeling. And of course, I can only say that from a feeling of inner security. And then you can live with insecurity. But the to define something as it is this or it is that, or he is a Muslim and he is a Jew and whatever, that then I have defined for my own comfort, rather than living with who is this person. I mean, he belongs to the Jewish faith, but he is still a different one from other people. And to live with that is, I think, what we need to do. And it, as a GP, I found that I had no difficulty with if people say, well, doctor, what is this? And I said, well, I don't know. I've checked out some things that I don't think it is cancer. I don't think it is this and this. So, but I am convinced that it is okay, but I don't exactly know what it is.
Brilliant. I think those pieces are so critical, modeling our own vulnerability and modeling our own uncertainty and our own willingness to not know, and also modeling our own mistakes, modeling our changes of thinking, our changes of direction. I think they're really key in this conversation, Jerry, because again, when people are very, very highly defended, they sort of lock on to safety, which or apparent safety, which is clinging to a position. But that admitting your own mistakes, admitting your own vulnerability, that's incredibly freeing.
I think we all have our own background and in positive and negative things, and that leads us to positions where we tend to seek within ourselves a degree of comfort, and in order not to feel the suffering of life all the time. And that's what we call the defenses, the psychological defenses. And one can be the very simple one of this is not true, or I haven't done that, it's him. And a child goes through all these stages. And I think those are what we call psychological defenses.
I agree with that. In TA, we talk about our frame of reference, and we talk about the frame of reference as being in many ways like a pair of glasses that we're wearing that filter out anything that doesn't fit with our sense of what the world is. In TA, again, the life script, the script that we're reading and following ourselves unconsciously. And so the idea of the frame of reference is we don't actually see that which threatens or challenges our script. Because if we were to go through every day challenging ourselves on everything, we'd get nothing done and we'd be a blithering jelly of insecurity and wobbliness. We need to firm ourselves up. We need to have our resilience. We need to have our worldview. And we operate from that worldview. And I think probably all the psychological professionals have a different way of languaging that. But the frame of reference is our defense against anything that doesn't fit with what makes me feel secure. And so really, it's fascinating to find out what other people's worldview is. But I think there's an even more fundamental question that needs to be asked, which comes back to what you said, Roz, which is I really don't bother that much these days with these conversations. Because actually, why am I having this conversation in the first place? What is the existential purpose of this conversation? Why am I not making love with my partner? Why am I not walking in nature with them? Why are we not building the garden shed? Why are we not doing vegetables? Why are we not taking the children for their next activity? Many, many Kiwis and Australians as well, Roz, have experienced complete rupture in their relationships because they've been nudged into conversations of disagreement. And the question is, why would I even be talking about something we disagree with when in fact, what is the purpose of the conversation? What could we be doing together that would align our nervous systems, that would secure our relationship, that would bring humanity and the heart back into our interaction. So we need to ask ourselves the question, I think, why am I even having this conversation?
If we're, again, keeping this within the frame of COVID and different worldviews, is it not that we're frightened that these people are going to be hurt if they take more vaccines, for example? So that's a very real concern.
I tell you what, Roz, I can't face pointing out to someone that they might die from the injection of some toxic material into their body. I literally cannot tolerate the pain I'm going to be witnessing if they were to believe my position. My position in my own heart is that they've been poisoned. So I don't like the idea of telling people, you know what, not only have you been poisoned, but you chose to poison yourself and you became susceptible to a bunch of psychological operations. And I feel like there, but for the grace of God, go I. I was not susceptible. It doesn't matter how hard they try their psychological operations. I'm not susceptible. I've always been my own man. I learned that from a very early age, from a very early form of trauma. I learned that from trauma. So I learned not to trust authority, and I learned to only think for myself. And, you know, that has its problems too, because sometimes we do need to defer to it. We don't have to reinvent the wheel all the time. We can listen to what other people have got and learned. So I think there, but for the grace of God, go I. I can't bear the conversation anymore. The people I wish to spend my time with are people who have faced the horror of what we're all going through. And those I find it really comfortable and soothing to be with. And I think I soothe them as well. And we help each other out, which brings me to the oxygen mask theory, Jerry's oxygen mask theory of how we survive these times, which is we bloody well take care of ourselves. We are the ones who are seeing the devil in all his horror. We're seeing the demon forces at play. We are seeing the horror on a daily basis. So our first job is to survive and to take care of ourselves, be around good people, find the solace of meditation or prayer, walk in nature, listen to great music, and above all, don't take this on ourselves. Be aware that there is a bigger story going on, and it's not. Thankfully, it's not down to each of us individually. There is something working out right now that is so profound and powerful for humanity. And again, it's a mystery. As René said, it's a mystery.
Yes. And I think we all have a positive purpose. And the whole of what is happening in the world, which can so easily get us into despair, is also there to actually help us to wake up and to real see what the actual values in life are. And the actual values are some very simple ones, actually love, compassion, care, be the taikiaiki, the guardian of the land in farming, the guardian of our own soul, the guardian of our community. Looking after each other. And indeed, we do that from different points of view and from different points of loneliness. But the first thing is to be really quite honest with ourselves of who we are, and then to look at it from that point of view and really to realize our loneliness. I have that still in my family. Of course, we had the same thing. So there are areas where there was a split in the view of how we see the COVID, et cetera. And that are still things that we don't talk about. But what I'm concerned about is when I see, as a doctor now, so many people, one this morning, diagnosed with advanced cancer, and our immune system being so disrupted and so reduced. And these people, suddenly all these turbo cancers that we see, I can on one man, one hand say, well, why didn't you see that it has to do with the chopping down of the immune system? Yes, that is one way, but that is one step. But the other step is to actually help the people through their suffering.
That is lovely, Rene. And I think, again, once again, you bring us back to this point of compassion, which is the point of what is going to serve the other person the most? What is going to serve our brothers and sisters? You know, we are, you know, the Bible says it beautifully, you know, love thy brother as thyself. And I think I would add sister to that, you know, and some of us don't love ourselves very well. So that's the self work. And some of us need to take that out to others and to ask ourselves, you know, when we hate and when we other, are we really living how we wish to live? Is that what we think this living is all about? That we should be able to have some we like and some we hate, you know, and that we can other everything. And I do believe that if you could imagine that there was a purpose behind all of this, and I know that's hard sometimes. I absolutely know how hard that is. But sometimes I think, what a perfect way to teach humanity to step up from partisan positions and judgments and step into a kind of a glory. You used the word caretakers. What was the word you used, Rene, for taking care? Like
Kaitiaki. Like the farmer in the German language is called the Landwirt, the host of the land. He is the guardian of the land.
Guardian, that was the word I was looking for, Rene, the guardians. And when we're othering someone or condemning someone or hating someone, are we being the guardians, the best guardians that we can be? Or do we need to find a way to step up and get a far bigger perspective on everything that is going on? Because perspective matters. And I think, Roz, I think you want to say something about that.
Perspective is everything, and it ties in with so many of the pieces we've talked about today.
Well, Roz, given we are talking about people's differences and also different perspectives, I'm going to suggest we take another music break and play a piece that you suggested, Rene, which is the famous Ginger Rogers and Freddie Astaire piece, all about perspective and difference, from the track Let's Call the Whole Thing Off. I mean, let's put everything into real perspective. How can we possibly carry on talking to each other if I say tomato and you say tomato?
This is Real People in the Psychotherapist's Chair with Jerry Pives on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, that was Ginger Rogers and Freddie Astaire singing Let's Call the Whole Thing Off. I wonder if you've ever felt like that. I hope you enjoyed that humorous musical break, seeing as we were talking about people's defenses, we were talking about frames of reference, and Roz, you were talking about perspectives. Can you expand more about how you see this issue of perspective?
I sort of see it as maybe in football, you can imagine you're a player on the field and you're running around with all these other players and trying to do your piece within there. Or if you've got that drone view above the entire field, so you can see every player and how they're all interacting and therefore how certain decisions might impact. Perspective is huge. It's coming out of that me, my, I, and going up and considering the whole field. It's seeing the wood for the trees. It's getting that eagle eye view where you can take yourself out of the extreme emotionality, the division, the hatred, the fear.
I love that analogy of the football match. When my daughter was about, I think she must have been 9, 10 maybe, she was playing football. And she, I would say this because I'm a very proud dad, but she was remarkably gifted and talented as a footballer. And I never pushed her into this area at all, but she'd be out there practicing on her own against the garage door with her football. She'd devise techniques. No one was helping her. She was getting on with it herself. And there was one, I can remember vividly, one particular match where she was in the midfield and the parents were all standing on the sideline. And we were about the halfway mark and the ball came to her. And there was this incredible moment where the ball came to her and she just did something quite remarkable. She just bounced the ball on her knee. She kind of fell over to one side and she kicked the ball right over her head. And it was quite the most remarkable move because that ball traveled right across the pitch, right into the pathway of another player on her side. And she was surrounded by players who were trying to tackle her. And she could not possibly have seen it. And she kicked that ball over and it landed right in the path. And that player just had a shot and they scored a goal. And there was a collective gasp by the parents. There was this like, did we just see what had happened? And in the car on the way back, I said, darling, how did you know to do that? And her answer has stayed with me. And it's been one of the most inspirational messages I got from any of my children. The answer came to me. She said, Daddy, it felt just like there was no other movement or way to go. It felt like this was the only way to move. And it was the only way the ball was going to go. And it was the only way to hit it. And I thought, wow.
Beautiful.
Wow. And
incredible.
Where was her perspective right then? Was she worrying about how well she was playing? Was she worrying about her tiredness? Was she worrying about all the parents? Because she was playing quite close at that point, all the parents on the line. Or was she in a different place? Was she in what we might call the big picture? Did she at that moment align herself with the balance of the whole universe, the very balance of the universe? And I'll never forget that moment. And several parents came up to me.
Goosebumps.
Yeah.
As you say there, goosebumps, yeah.
Do you know, I don't think I've ever told her the significance of that moment. I will have a conversation with her. She's now grown up and beautiful and amazing. But, you know, that is something that will always stay with me. It's one of those, what I call deathbed pouches. You know, I have a little pouch, a metaphorical pouch around my waist, by my waist. And there are some experiences that I put in that pouch because they're the things I want to remember just before I pass over.
That's a beautiful story. And it actually shows how everything that we do, that we think, every word that we speak has a far stronger dimension than we see, because indeed it is that picture. And you started talking before you talked about your daughter, you talked about the wider picture of it. And we're all players in this same game of life. And somehow to play the game together and realizing that everybody has his or her role to play in that. And often that role is one of loneliness when we go through suffering. So if we realize that we all go through these parts of loneliness, so that I can help your loneliness by my loneliness, by realizing our togetherness in that. And I think that is really what communication is all about. It's the same as with a patient. It's a question of, as we said before, the patient wants to be heard, wants to be acknowledged. And by doing that, that active dynamic between the two of us, there is the third much bigger part of the interest, that what is in between, that place between my patient and myself, and that is bigger than each one of us separate.
And I think as well, as you're talking about the therapeutic relationship, René, what's coming to me very much, and from what you were saying, Jerry, as well, is that ultimately, rather than us thinking of how can we convince this person, it ultimately comes down to the heart piece, which is that being with, yes, that we can be alongside people as they're experiencing their own journey, their own role in this game, as it were. But ultimately, it has to come back to them going in themselves. We can't tell them these pieces. They'll figure it out for themselves, but we can be there alongside them as they do.
And Roz, I think you emphasize so importantly the threat, the dominance, bringing us right back to the beginning of this conversation, the threat and the dominance, whereas the key issue is, well, really the only question to be asked when we're with someone is, how can I help this person feel safe?
Hallelujah. Yeah.
So is what I'm doing likely to help this person feel safe? How can we shoot the breeze together? You know, how do we get each other into a place where we can, you know, just shoot the breeze together?
I have always a problem with this idea of safe. That has been misused so much, and the whole health and safety, the whole, it is safe and effective. I'm afraid that I have become allergic to that. Life is risky. Life is about the unknown. It is the way, how do I deal with the unknown? I cannot take away that unknown. I can do as if I take away by closing my eyes or getting drunk every day or whatever. But then I simply don't acknowledge the essence of life, that life is an affair of growth in love, in purpose, and in trying to know myself with an enormous respect for the individual path that each one has to go. And together we can do that, but we cannot do that by taking away these boundaries as if they don't exist. And this idea of safety, I'm afraid I've become really allergic to that. And I've always been that as a child. I always took risks.
For me, I'm talking about the relational safety, safe in our relationship.
That's a question of respect. That's a question of, I love the being who you are. I may not understand you, and I may disagree completely with you, and you have to live with the consequences of your lifestyle. And if that means that you want to have every injection that is possible in God knows what pandemics that come, well, all right, that is your choice. I respect that. I disagree with it. And for my life, that's not what I'm going to do. I stand for what I stand for. But I will, to the end of my life, want to defend your freedom to think what you think.
It's what I love most about being around you two, because I get this. We accidentally agree on quite a lot. I don't think the three of us agree on everything, but what I get from being around you two is I get an enormous sense of respectfulness, and that I can speak my truth. And actually, through that respect, mm-hmm. I think respect is an expression of love. Because love says precisely what you just described, Renee. It says, I love you, therefore you are free 100% to be you. I do not seek to shape you in my image.
Mm-hmm. And for me, that comes back to, you are safe to be who you are. My love holds all iterations of you, whatever, as you say, opinions you don't agree with, different points of view, but you're safe. So that's how I use safe. It's the relationship is safe.
Yeah, I think the big division in mankind and what is happening at the moment, both individually and as societies and the whole way how the world is going, is actually those who, in one way or other, have a comprehension of purpose in life, of a transcendent type of purpose in life, and those who haven't. Because if you don't, then of course you only have this life. And so then you must make the most of it. And then you would say, well, whatever happens, I want to prevent damage to myself or damage to the earth or damage to the other. If I believe in a transcendence, I have far more freedom to actually say yes or no. It's an interesting part that I think I won't get too deep into personality in person, but where a very dear, intimate relationship where we split up, in fact, was the idea of the one saying it's better to be a living coward than a dead hero. And I essentially disagree with that. And I can only disagree with that if I see things in a transcendental perspective. And I think that is where the world is at the moment.
Me too.
I love how this has come from your challenge, Renee, of saying that I want to know how I contribute to the sense of safety of the person I'm talking to. And your challenge of that is very real, because if we go too far down that line, as I think about it, we sense that we're responsible for their safety, which is the whole health and safety malarkey that has destroyed so much of the world. And also it's the wokeishness that said, oh, when you say that, I don't feel safe, you know, as if, well, okay, well, I say what I say. I wonder if only the listeners could have seen Renee, who did this remarkable sort of flapping out. But, you know,
I wish everyone could see us. Yeah.
And it makes it all too pink. That it just makes the whole bloody thing too pink. And we should not do that. It's lovely to see romantic movies and they live happily ever after. Wonderful. That's one part of life. But let's not take that to the total part of life. Let's not take all the danger and all the risk out of life, because that is denying the essence of life.
Oh, Renee, I love your passion, man. And I love, I just hope your heart rate has not gone too high. It's like, see, you're getting so much. And this is at the heart of what being human is and what life is, right? We're not talking about how to behave with A or B or C. We're talking the very core elements of life. And those are worth getting worked up about and passionate about. So much of me happens with imagery, and it's because I've got a child part of me that is far wiser than I am. And he picks up on stuff and he talks to me by images. He's a part of me, obviously. And the image that came to me in this conversation, don't enter too much into the mind of Jerry Pius, but the image that came to me was of a small boat or a yacht in stormy waters. And there's me and this other person. And I think that image is saying to me, you know, we need to be together and good with each other to pull ourselves through this storm. We can't be at odds with each other. We cannot be undermining each other when you've got to go and over there and bring in the jib. And then you've also got to come over and I've got to hold the rudder and we've got to stay in this through this storm. So the challenge of being in the storm, the risk of life is like being in the storm. But when I say, how do I make this person safe? I think what I'm really, and I hadn't thought about this before, I'm really talking about how do me and thee together get through this? How do we survive and grow and triumph through the risk and the challenges of life? That's the image that's coming to me at the moment.
And I think that has to do with, I want to stand guard over the sanctity of you as a human being, your dignity, your honesty. That is what is important to me. And I stand firmly for that, however much I might disagree with you, because I cannot know who you are. I can only know a little bit about you. And I know a little bit more about myself, but even that is very partial. But I really, the dignity of the human being, that is what is Article 1 in the German Constitution after the war. That the German state stands guard over the dignity of the human being. That is the number one. And okay, that is, you can see how that in the last few years have been terribly, terribly abused, just like every constitution has been completely abused for political advantage and more commercial advantage, because we have become so commercialized ourselves and we don't even see it. But it's perhaps in this whole aspect of what's happening through the 4 years, I've learned more than probably I've learned for most of my life. And it's been bloody hard. But it is worthwhile, because somehow in the whole evolution of my life, I have learned more respect, yeah, more love, more understanding, at the same also more knowledge and insight of evil forces than I ever had.
Wow.
Jerry's on, Renee's on fire.
I didn't think I was doing too badly either, Roz, but I do agree with you. Well, I think we're closing. I think we've said a great deal about the issue of how we talk to people. I'm so excited by this conversation, and I'm so proud to know both of you and to be able to talk so freely and honestly and openly and to share our own perceptions. And I think we need to just find a way to close out this conversation. Is there anything either of you wish to say in our closing together?
We're talking about how in many ways, because we don't quite understand each other, we speak different languages. And the importance of learning languages in education, whether it is speaking both Tureo and English, or French, English, and whatever language, it tries to help to form bridges into understanding a little bit more of the mystery of the other. You say tomato, I say tomato. You probably remember that song. And so they bring a harmony in that song, despite pronouncing things differently. And I think that is where a bridging is possible. On the other hand, if a bridging is where we lose our own self, we have made a compromise that leads nowhere.
I would like to read a prayer, which is not something that normally comes from me, but I actually have this blue tacked to my screen and I read it every day. And it's the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood and to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in the giving that we receive, and it is in the pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life.
Thank you. Beautiful. Renee, what would you like to close with?
I would say gratitude, love, and living within security, within trust in myself, trust within the other human being who I encounter, and that there is a higher purpose in our encounter.
Amen.
Exactly. So I would like to close this edition of Psychobabble as my contribution to the preamble of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. It says this: Whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. That's not a bad ending, is it? Thank you so much, both of you, for giving up your time to spend here in the psychobabble room. And where, in fact, we do the very opposite of psychobabble. It's an ironic title, isn't it, psychobabble? It's the exact opposite. We're turning it from babble into clarity.
But we will still finish with the Alan Parson Project playing psychobabble. Thank you so much for listening. And don't forget to write in and share your thoughts with us. And in case you've only just tuned in at the end of the show, you've been listening to the Psychobabble panel with myself, Jerry Pives, a registered psychotherapist, Ros Neelan-Cook over in Australia, a deregistered psychologist, and René de Monchy, doctor, psychiatrist, and psychotherapist here in New Zealand. Don't forget, you can listen in every other Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Yes, I've got the weekend spot. Or you can also have muffin and tea with me at 4 p.m. every other Sunday afternoon. So once again, send your texts to 2057 or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. Have a great weekend and may God's blessings pour down upon you and all your loved ones.
You've been listening to Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with Jerry Pives. Tuesdays from 1 p.m. on RCR, Reality Check Radio.